Welcome back, listeners, to the David Crick Podcast. My name is Krista Swanepoel, and this is the second installment of a series of episodes featuring artists from the all-female printmaking collective known as the Printing Girls. Each episode of the series will feature one of the artists from this collective. This group of professional South African-based artists is a platform exclusively for women printmakers to share ideas and skills, network and exhibit together. I'm very excited to introduce today's guest, German-born artist Fiver Locker. Welcome to the podcast, Fiver. Would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Hello, my name is Fiver. I'm a printmaker and I was born in Germany, but I haven't lived there for a very long time. And I nowadays spend half of my year here in South Africa and the other half in the Netherlands, where I live on a boat.
Can you tell me a bit about your background and what led you to pursue art?
My mother was an artist and a art teacher. And when we were young, me and my brothers were the guinea pigs for my mother's art lessons. So she would try the things out on us to see if they worked with kids. So I've been making art of some kind as long as I can remember, really. I've always been doing it. I didn't really pursue it. After school, I left Germany. I worked in the peace movement and spent 10 years in political activities and demonstrations and actions. And then I found that the urge for making art was actually too great for me to not do it. And so I started painting, and then I realized that I really needed some tuition. So I took some classes, and then my tutors encouraged me to take a degree course. So I started theater design, because the whole time I really have never been able to fix on one thing. I'm very much a Renaissance woman. I kind of like to do everything. I'm not an expert in anything, but I just love learning new things, and I love trying out things, and I love playing. I've been a filmmaker in the past, and I've been a photographer, and I've worked in the theater. I've been a writer, and I've done lots and lots of different things, because I get very excited about things, and then I do them, and then I do them for a while, and then something else excites me. And currently, although that is for the last 8 years, it's been printmaking.
Would you say that there's an overall theme or concept that pervades your artistic practice, all of your creative endeavors like film and writing and now printmaking? Do you think there's a characteristic theme or concept that you can recognize in each and every one of those, something that is characteristic of you?
Yes, I think the thing that is most important to me, and which is one big reason why I make art anyway, and I've done many of the other things, is that I feel very strongly about lots of things, about injustice, about discrimination, about the state of the world, about the climate, about the status of women, about gay rights. I feel very strongly about these things, and in the past, I've taken direct action in order to change things. When I make art now, it's very important for me what the content of the work is. So I make things that I like to look at, and other people hopefully too. But for me, the driving force is to communicate in such a way that people learn something, open their eyes to something, and to really see the world in a slightly different way. I always have the saying that because I've spent a lot of time in my life living in countries that are not my home country, what seems normal to me is entirely weird to somebody else. So what I think is like how one should live life, or how things should be, is completely beyond the pale to other people. And the same when I go, usually it's me going to other people's places and they think, well, that's how we should live life. And I think, that's so weird. That's so strange. That's so exotic. I'm often looking on from the outside, and I feel like my urge to try and help people look beyond their everyday and to see that we can change the world. We can make the world a better place. I'm an eternal optimist. And that really is my mission as an observer, as somebody who looks in from the outside. I can say, hey, you know that thing that you're always doing? Why don't we like look at it from a different angle? So I think probably in if you're talking about a through line through all my work, that's probably, I would say that was it.
I can really see that in your work, or the ones that I've seen so far, the perspective shifting. I'm also very fascinated by the aesthetics of your works. If I may, I would describe it as very eclectic and richly saturated, like a visual encyclopedia. How would you describe your visual language?
I am a collector. And I could probably be a hoarder if I wasn't living on a boat, which is very small. But yes, you're right in saying that I work with lots of layers and my work takes a long time to produce. The piece that is here in the show probably took 2 years to come to fruition. And that's because the work itself is a collage, a screen print on top of some painted maps. The process of coming up with it and most of my things is very iterative. I often start in the studio by just playing, by just making backgrounds or printing on paper or trying out a new technique, doing some trace monotypes or some screen prints or something. I don't really think too much. I often recycle old material, so I don't really think too much about what the final image is going to look like. I don't plan out what the picture is. So the layers build up. So I'll make something and then I'll shove it in a corner and I work on something else. And then when I want to do something, I'll see what I've got and what I can work on top of. I very rarely work on white paper because I already have lots and lots of stuff that I can work on top of. So what you're seeing is actually often, the layers are often temporal layers. There's stuff that's really old. I made it a long time ago and I put something on top and then I put it away again. And then I make a collage on my iPad. I put images together that I've been collecting over years. And this piece was made as a collage on the iPad and then turned it to a CMYK screen print. So even that, even though the image that looks very much unified as a full color screen print is collected over time. When the print was finished, I looked at it and I left it for 6 months and I thought, it needs something else. And eventually I came up with the idea of putting the nautical lines in gold or print them over the top in gold. And so the work has taken a long time to make, but that's because it has my history of thinking in the work.
This intuitive process that you use to create these works really shines through. Now that I've met you and we're sitting here together and I can see you've got these amazing glasses on, your jewelry and everything you're wearing is very bright and carefully curated. It's interesting to me that you said that you don't plan it out, the artworks, you build them up. I feel like a piece of your personality really shines through. Your character shines through in the work. The artwork you were talking about is called Freiheit 1693, and it's quite spectacular, this work. To our listeners on Spotify, I'll attach a link in the description to view this work. It is a very vibrant screen print with the gold leaf. You said the nautical lines. To me, it looked like sunbeams. And the title you said earlier before we started recording is Dutch. What does this refer to?
This print is a part of a series of works that I've been working on for a couple of years now. It's about the history of slavery and it's about white privilege. So I want to explain that a little bit. I'm a white European and I live in South Africa for half the year. It has made me very aware as a European, the world isn't Europe. The world is much bigger. The thing that I was talking about earlier, things that look really normal to me, are really weird to other people in other countries. It really applies to Europeans because we are so used to going everywhere in the world and everybody just caters to us. The world is focused towards Europe and North America. And so I feel there's a lot of privilege there that until a few years ago, until recently I started traveling through Africa, I never was aware of. And I don't think that most people that I know of back in Europe are not aware of that. So the sense that we have all these advantages that are built in, they're not like, don't come from a rich background. I have a good education, but that's like most people I know in Europe have a good education. It's all these things that are like built in. I didn't have to do anything for them. They're just there. And so I've been very aware of this. When I walk around Europe nowadays, I look at these places that were built on colonialism and empire. Especially I spent a lot of time living in the UK, so there's a whole lot of architecture and wealth and tradition and everything built around that. Then a few years ago, I moved to the Netherlands and I realized that while the British are actually talking about the legacy of empire and the legacy of colonialism, the Dutch had this idea that, we traded slaves, but we traded everything. It wasn't really about slaves. It was, we're just a little country that's very tolerant. And so that kind of set me off. And then I started researching, and I do this a lot. I do a lot of research. So I love history. My last project, I did a lot of scientific research. I do a lot of reading and almost writing essays and researching. And I realized that the Dutch really have a very limited view of their importance in the colonial and empire history. So the title of the work is the name, a very ironic name, of a slave ship. So Vrijheid is actually freedom. in English. And so it is not just a title of a ship, but it is a very ironic title for a slave ship. So the Dutch at one point had 30% of the slave trade, which is a lot. And so the series that I'm working on is really looking at what our responsibility as Europeans is. Because history is today. History is not over. It's complex and it's difficult and it's not. There's no a simple solution to it. And I don't pretend that there is. But I would like to start people to at least notice that there is more to history than what they've been taught in school or what is a sort of superficial learning, and that there is a legacy of that, and the legacy that we live in today, which is a very unequal world. We're in a very difficult place in world history, and so that's how I express those thinkings and those that research and those feelings. It's thinking and feeling and research. It's not just some sort of thought process. For me, it starts off as an emotional thing.
Your work is purposefully subverting this Eurocentric gaze. That is very important, especially the research and all of the research that you put into it. I want to ask you about the figures, the images in this work. I haven't seen images like those before, and I think it's because usually images in those styles of important figures from the 17th and 18th century are white men. Where did you get those images that you've collaged together? You said you've been collecting them for a very long time.
It's interesting, those images, because they are images of dignified and civilized and educated and powerful and high status black people. One of the things for me when people talk about slavery is most of the things that we see are scenes of degradation and suffering and victimhood. It was important for me to look, I can't speak for black historians. I read them. I can't speak for black culture. I can speak only for me. And for me, what was interesting is the things that I learned in my research are that the process and the history of slavery is not as simple as white overpowered black and blacks are victims and whites are the conquerors. It's not as simple as that. Now, this image particularly is, I've taken images of people who were really involved in the meeting of the West and the rest of the world at really before the beginning of slavery, so before the beginning of colonial trade in slaves. The figure on the top left, for example, is the envoy of the Kingdom of Benin to the Portuguese court. Now, he was very high status, he was a very educated man, and he was very high status in Portugal too. Portugal at one point had something like 30% black inhabitants because there was so much trade, and because Portugal wasn't an empire force in the beginning. None of the West was. When the Europeans first went, for example, to Africa and to East Asia, there were incredibly sophisticated countries and systems there in place. And so what fascinated me is this moment before where there was an exchange, there was a mutual interest. There was you got these cool birds. Oh, you got those cool trees. Oh, well, how do you eat? And what do you do for transport? So there was very much a sort of mutual knowledge that was a learning that was going on that was beyond any kind of exploitative thing. It was really about getting to know each other. And for me, that image is a very positive image because it is showing people who had their own cultures, their own setups, their own systems, and they were very strong. And it wasn't about being taken over. And I think that one of the biggest things that I learned from reading Black history and the history of the world, really. I mean, it's much easier to say the history of the world rather than the history of Europe, which is what we normally learn. And that is that the idea of the inferiority of black people is a post hoc explanation. Of course, you can't trade people if you think that they're your equal. You can't sell them and buy them and kill them and do what you like with them. You can only do it if you think they're inferior. They are not really human. And so once the slave trade started, that is when it became really important to make that distinction between color. And when the picture that I made, these people didn't, they saw that they were each other, were different colors, but that wasn't really, that was just another thing that you have these weird birds and we have those weird trees. It was more like that. And I think that to me was it's a very interesting way of thinking about race and about different cultures, because it's not about you're better than me or you're worse than me. It's more about like, oh, what do you do? Oh, you do it like this. And I experience this all the time when I go to a new country. your public transport runs like this, or your houses are like that. That's, I get this all the time, and it was the same then. Mm. I think that there was definitely a mutual interest and a mutual learning, and it wasn't exploitative.
Yeah, it's pre-indoctrination, essentially. Mm. Racism, I feel, in my opinion, is fabricated for people to justify, like you said, to justify their horrible actions. They created this. It's very interesting. I've never heard this part of history before. We never learned about anything that happened before that. And it is so interesting to hear this from you and to see these beautiful images that you've collected. To move on to the more technical aspect of this work, I believe this work is a CMYK screen print. From what I understand is that this technique was used for a very long time as a method of color reproduction for mass-produced items like magazines or patterned textiles, but you use it to create fine art. Besides the fact that the resulting images are so stunningly vibrant, does this screen printing method hold any kind of significance to your work?
I wanted to do it because it looked really hard. It looked really difficult. I do screen printing in my studio, and I normally have a screen and it's got an image on it, and I'll print it. And then I might put it on a different part of the page and I print it again. So I use my screen printing in a very simple way, more like stenciling than anything else. And I love screen printing. I think it's a really great technique because you can not only make very precise and very beautiful considered images that you have to work out beforehand and layer them and do all these cool things, but I learned that you can also use them very freely, the way that I use them in my studio. But I'm terrible with registration. Like, I don't register things because I'm really bad at it. So I really wanted to do something that was not what I normally do. And it was a real challenge to me, and I immediately knew that there was no way I was going to do this myself. So Claudia from Chocolate Ink Studio helped me with this. And I went to see her, and she's very positive, and she's very encouraging. And she said, yes, we can do this. She says she doesn't normally, because it is a commercial process. And normally you print something like that and you print 100 or 1,000 or 10,000. Mm. It's an old analog way of printing color, really. Nowadays, digital printing is different, but with analog printing, it was a really good way of making color images. But she said she'd do it for me, and we only made 9. And I love the fact that there are only 9, even though it is a very commercial process. Not that she did it commercially, because she literally printed these by hand, and she is the queen of registration, so really it was not a problem for her. She told me how to adjust the image and how to make it so that we could put it onto screens, and then she did her magic, and it was absolutely amazing. And I helped by putting bits of paper down and washing the screen and things like that. But really, it was very much her technical expertise, and I absolutely loved watching somebody who's so good at what they're doing technically. And I actually, the best thing about it was that when you print, so we printed, we had these painted maps. And so in order to get a really good image with a real pop, we printed the outline of everything in white first. So there would be a white background. So we did that, and that looks just interesting. And then we printed the yellow on top, and that looked kind of like nothing very much. And then we printed the cyan, I think, on top of that. And it started to look like something, but really nothing particularly. Then we printed the magenta, and it looked better. Every time I was like, oh yeah, I can see this is coming. And then we printed the black on top. And I'll tell you, it was like magic. Like suddenly the image was there. It was so amazing. It was such an amazing way of seeing how a print comes together. And I feel much more like there's a printing process that I've learned that is so, it's like analog photography. Once you get it, it goes back into everything else, you know, the way the colors melded together to suddenly make something that looks just like a photograph. So yes, I did it because it was hard. Then I got some help. And then I loved doing it because it was such an inspiring process. It was so fantastic. And to work with somebody who's that good.
I'm a huge fan of CMYK prints. They are so beautiful. It's almost as if you look at a little analog photo under a microscope, because obviously those particles are so enlarged. And I've had the privilege of seeing a person make them in real life. And I know if you are 2 millimeters off with the registration, your image goes from a beautiful portrait to just a mess. And it really is, it's essentially an optical illusion, because the colors don't get mixed. We're using the flat colors out of the tubes, the magenta, the cyan, the yellow, and the black. And the next thing you know, it all comes together and it just overlays in such a way that it's a exact perfect face.
Yeah, and the colors are not, they don't look like particularly good colors. They look very loud.
Yeah.
And you think like, how are you going to get a brown out of that? And the images that I have there, they are old images. They're old etchings and old paintings and very old, like hundreds of years old. Mm-hmm. I did kind of think like, how are we going to get this out of these? And it's amazing because it just, the half tone of each of those colors, then the eye is deceived to make all these shades, all this whole range. So it's fantastic.
It's like a very advanced form of pointillism painting.
Yes, exactly.
You mentioned Claudia earlier. This collaboration with her, was this before or after you joined the Printing Girls?
It was after.
So as I've mentioned earlier, Faber is a member of an all-female artist collective called the Printing Girls. Can you tell me a bit about how you came to be a part of this group and what it has been like for you to be part of such a diverse collective of fellow printmakers?
I don't actually remember how I came across the Printing Girls in the beginning. They didn't have a name then, so it was very, very early on. I know that there was a call for women printmakers to submit for exhibitions at the Bioscope in Maboneng. And they'd done a deal where we'd have a monthly theme and it was based on something that they were showing in the cinema. I was like, oh, cool, that's great. Like, I get to put stuff into group shows. I always love group shows because I always love to see everybody else's work. So I submitted a couple of times and then I heard that there were so many submissions and there were so many people interested that we would have a meeting and we'd get together and see what would happen. So we met in a park somewhere in the south of Johannesburg, I can't remember which park, and it was mad. There were so many women there. It was quite crazy. We had to pull all the other tables together and we had a whole afternoon of just crazy talking about who we were and what we were doing and why, like, would it be a good idea to get together as women printmakers? And it was just amazing because I had been in Joburg for a few years and I already had a studio, I think, in Newtown. And Joburg is a very easy place to get to know other artists. It's super friendly. But I found it very hard to meet other women artists and especially other women printmakers. It was very difficult. I don't know. I thought, well, there just maybe aren't so many. And it turned out there were loads because that meeting was really just Joburg women printmakers. So it was really exciting and we kind of went off and did it. It's just been fantastic. I absolutely love it. I love being part of a community. I love being a part of a women's community. I think that we are incredibly supportive of each other. And I think that South African artists are very supportive of each other. Generally, I find it a very welcoming community compared to others that I've experienced. But I'm a feminist and I've always loved working with women.
Mm.
And so for me, it was absolutely no brainer. And I've been really, really excited about it ever since we started.
I think it is so fantastic that this collective started essentially in a park in Johannesburg and now it has women from all over South Africa. And it is so important to have a platform that elevates the voices of not only printmakers as important artists, because for a long time print has been undermined, but women artists who have been undermined for an even longer time. It is so important for women printmakers to have a space that is their own, that they can elevate their own voices and they don't get overpowered and everyone's on an equal footing and everyone gets to learn and exchange knowledge. It's really all about collaborating and learning from each other, learning printmaking techniques. The previous printing girl I interviewed, Laureen Kuhn-Bortma, described, for example, stone lithography. And now we're talking about silkscreen. And it is just so wonderful to hear from all of these very different and diverse women in this group, how they've learned from each other and what we can learn from you.
I think that there's no way that I could have learned as much about printmaking techniques. I really had no idea before I started making my first lino cut.
Mm.
I hadn't really done any printmaking in the past. I think I did an etching once a long time ago. very small. I will start from scratch. I'm not a professional printmaker like some of the other women in our group. I'm not a full-time printmaker making a living from it, but I always know that if I have a question about anything, about where to get something from, or what materials do you use for this, or how does this work, or do you have a trick for this, the printing girls are always there. And we run workshops, we are running support for other printmakers to be able to take part in exhibitions. We do some financial support. We have a WhatsApp group. We feature women printmakers in the Instagram on a regular basis. And it's just been really, it's just really amazing. I mean, look, Louise Bourgeois, I think it was, who said that if you're a woman artist, you're going to be famous when you're dead, if you're lucky. You're not going to be famous in your lifetime. If you're famous in your lifetime, you're going to be forgotten when you're dead. So it's one or the other. And I think that that's really something that for me is really important, because I think that that is exactly what happens. I'm constantly discovering new women artists that I've never heard of. And I've been studying feminist women's art for like 30 years. And I find these women who were hugely famous in their lifetime, and then they die, and then 30 years later, maybe they have a show. You know, and it just makes me crazy. And I think that, and I know that that's going to happen to the rest of us, because in this day and age, it's not going to be any different. Yes, we now have women at Tate Modern and at the Met or whatever, but in terms of longevity, I think that that is a really difficult thing. And I think so that at least the very least we can do is support each other when we're alive.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's difficult, especially nowadays, seeing what's happening in Iran. We live in this big city and we think we're in this beautiful bubble where men and women are equal now, but it's really just, it's just a little coat of gloss paint. It's really not as advanced or progressive as we think it is. And then you look at the news and it's even worse than you could have possibly imagined. It is very important for women artists to support themselves.
I think what often happens is that women might be doing really well in their lifetime, and they might actually sell and make a living and be quite well known and have shows. But what often happens is that they become kind of marginalized afterwards, and then it's like special interest. You know, here's the real art and here's the women's art.
Yeah,
the women's art is about women. And so it's like, you know, like if you're interested in that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that that hasn't really changed. And I think that it's really interesting you talk about Iran, because a few years ago I went to see a show at Tate Modern of Farah Nissa Saeed. You might never have heard of her. She was a hugely famous Iranian artist in the 50s and 60s. Massive, sold for vast amounts of money. I'd never heard of her until she had a show at Tate Modern, and she's been dead for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I think that that happens a lot, and it really frustrates me, because now I'm an artist and I make serious art, and I know that the chances of it having any kind of impact beyond my work, beyond my lifetime, or beyond my activity of my self-promotion is really slim, because it's going to be a niche subject of women art, women printmakers in South Africa. I mean, there was a show in February, and they haven't even made a catalogue. It was a huge show. It had fantastic range of women artists from lots of printmakers, painters, sculptors. I had never heard of most of them, of like 80 years or 100 years or something. It was crazy. There's no catalogue. That show is just going to go. It's going to disappear into thin air. And I photographed everything. And I asked them where the catalogue was, and they said they'd let me know, and I keep asking them every few months, and there isn't going to be one, I don't think. And I think that that's what happens. It's like, oh, well done, you did some great work. Never mind, we're moving on, because nobody's going to write about you.
That is such a pity, and I feel like it's so important for women to have conversations like the one we're having now, and more importantly, it's being recorded. It's important to have these conversations and to publish them and to keep them somewhere permanent, like the internet. And we must have more and more of these conversations, and we need to showcase and celebrate groups like the Printing Girls, who are working so hard to build a legacy and not continue the cycle of making art and then being forgotten because you're a woman.
Yes, absolutely. Totally agree. 100%.
This has been such a lovely conversation. I didn't expect for us to be diving into feminism and colonialism and critical race theory, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I think this is a very important conversation to have, and not a lot of people talk about this. Before we close things off, I just wanted to know, I'm sure a lot of our listeners would like to keep up to date with you and follow you and see what you're doing on your journeys. Is there any way that they can go look at more of your work, learn more about you, like a website or social media?
So I have a website. It's fiverlocker.com. Very easy. I'm mostly active on Instagram. My studio is called Rabbit Productions. Rabbit, like the animal, mm-hmm. with the ears. Because the name, my name Fiverr, which I picked myself, comes from a book about rabbits. And so my Instagram handle is Rabbit Productions. So you can look that up. And yeah, and my studio is in Fordsburg. If you are in Johannesburg, come and visit me. 38 Lillian Road. You can always come. And we have a open studio. So there's me and a bunch of other artists at 38 Lillian Road. And we have an open studio on the 10th and 11th of December. And we have those once or twice a year.
And these open studios, do you advertise them on your Instagram? So people can follow you and then see when the next one is going to be, if they can't make it to this one.
Yeah, absolutely. There's Instagram is going to have the information, and that's probably the best place to find out what's new.
Yeah, that is so great. I'm definitely going to come stop by. All right. And then lastly, I want to know, is there anything you're working on at the moment? Is there anything that we can expect to see from you in the next year or so? Anything that you're excited to tell us about?
So this series that I'm working on now, that the Screenprint is a part of, it's going to be a big collection of work. It's going to be a big body of work. I've already shown in other exhibitions a couple of bits and pieces. I'm working on sketchbooks. I'm working on embroideries. I'm working on a large triptych. It's going to be a range of techniques. It's going to be a range of materials, but going to be on the same subject. I'm expecting to put together sort of a show for that at some stage when I feel like I have enough of a body of work to show. But it's an ongoing thing, and this has been going for a while, so it's interesting because often I make bodies of work in a very limited time space, but this one seems to be running and running. Mm. I'm really fascinated with the subject.
I'm so excited to see it, especially because you've shared so much knowledge with me. But like I said earlier, things that happened pre-colonialism that I wasn't even aware of, and I'm looking forward to learning more about these topics and these subjects from you and from visiting your studio and seeing the new works that you create. I think it's very exciting. Thank you so much for joining us today, Fiverr.
No, thank you for having me. It's been absolutely amazing to be able to talk about my work at such great length. It's been brilliant. Thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to part 2 of the Printing Girls special series. To listen to the first part, visit the link in the description or head over to www.davidcritprojects.com, where you can find all of our episodes as well as view photos. Visit the description below to find links to find out more about what we chatted about today. Please remember to subscribe and join us again for the next episode of this series.